So, for the last, few weeks, I've been in the book of Exodus, and I want to build this up, but I probably should just say it. I have always thought, and I have thought wrong, that as God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses, we know that it was God's handwriting. It was God who made the tablets, and he gave his commandments. After he spoke them in Exodus 20, he wrote them down and put them on tablets. Moses goes for quite a while with Joshua. It's about 40 days, and he comes back, and you remember the whole thing in chapter 32, where the people have built a calf for themselves. They claim it's a miraculous thing as they threw the gold in and out leapt a calf, but we all know better. They built a calf for themselves. They worship the calf. As Moses and Joshua come down from the mountain, Joshua says it sounds like war. Well, he's a warrior. He's a fighter, so he hears things, and he's like, that's how I hear it. Moses says, no, it's a party. They're celebrating something. And so when they get down from the mountain, they realize, sure enough, they're worshiping this golden calf. Moses takes the two things that are in his hands and just smashes them. And that shows you not that he disrespected God or God's law. It's just he took what was in his hands and he threw it down. I've always thought, and this is where I thought wrong, that Moses did the second set. And that's right to a half extent, but wrong in the other half. Notice with me in Exodus chapter 34, what we're going to be talking about tonight, by the way, is the new covenant. But I want to kind of build this up a little bit, because I do think there was reverence from Israel toward Moses. And it was an uncanny sort of thing. They didn't worship Moses. At no point do they bow down to Moses. But there is this such high reverence for Moses and the law. Exodus chapter 34, and specifically you'll notice with me three verses. We're going to read together verses 1 through 9. The Lord said to Moses, cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. So the first thing, and this is really the main thing that I was saying that I got wrong, is if somebody asked who did the second set of the Ten Commandments, I thought Moses did. And like I said, it's half right because Moses is told to cut out rocks, tablets. And typically, these wouldn't be small. It's not like we think small, dinky, like a Kindle or an iPad or something. They would be larger than that. I know the famous movie with Charlton Heston, he's carrying these very large slabs. And I'm sure they're made out of foam in his TV production or his movie production. The reality is they probably were large enough, but small enough because if you're going to carry rock, you don't want it too heavy. You could imagine something that's that tall and that wide, and you've got two sets of it, and you're like walking around. There's just no way to do that. But it was smaller than that, but not so small that you couldn't write on it. But God wrote both of them. He wrote the first set. He wrote the second. Because he tells Moses, you need to cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first. I'll say this real quick, too. The tablets, why there were two tablets, some have supposed that you would write five commandments on the one and five commandments on the other. Not saying that that's absolutely wrong, because we just don't know, but there is the high likelihood that on one tablet were all Ten Commandments, and on the other tablet were all Ten Commandments. In other words, it's a covenant, a contract between God and Israel. And so where they kept the copies, not only for themselves, but for God himself, was in the ark. That would be in the holy place of the temple. And that seems more likely. It was two copies of the old law. But God again says, you cut it out, I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which you broke. Be ready by the morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. Verse 3, no one will come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain. Let no flocks or herds graze opposite the mountain. And so Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first. He rose early in the morning. He went up to Sinai as the Lord commanded and took in his hands two tablets of stone. The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there. and proclaimed the name of the Lord. In other words, he announced himself. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generation. And Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. And he said, if I now have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. Now, what we've skipped from chapter 32 to 34 is Moses interceding for the people, pleading with God not to kill them. Remember, God at one point says, look, I've had enough of these people. They really are stiff-necked. You've said they're stiff-necked. They indeed are stiff-necked. I'm going to kill them all, and we'll start all over with you. And Moses said, if you do that, Egypt's going to mock you. Anybody who hears about this is just going to mock you. So don't do this. He pleads for their life, and God relents. He, according to the scripture, he changes his mind and doesn't do what he said he was going to do. But then the covenant, starting in verse 10 of chapter 34, is renewed. It's restated. It is given to Moses again. And like I'm saying, it is this reverence that the people seem to have for Moses. I highlight verse 5 and verse 8 with you. In verse 5, the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there. I don't know how you illustrate that. Is it the presence of the Lord and Moses felt the presence? Have you ever been in a room and you kind of like, you feel there's somebody else in here with me? You know, you may even, if you're in a dark room, one of the moments in my life I remember, I used to sneak out when I was a kid and go out and go do things, come home. And one of the strangest things is, it was a funny thing looking back on it. I snuck out and was out for a few hours and came in. And as I came in and got in my bed, there was somebody in the bed. And that totally freaked me out. I screamed. Yeah, I did. I remember screaming. It was loud. It was my mom. And she was like, I wondered when you were going to come home. Just, you know, and what do you say? I can't say, well, I've been in bed with you the whole time. No, it was not that moment. I came into bed and there she was. So, but, you know, I sensed as I came into the room in the middle of the night, and I don't know what time it was, to be honest with you, that there was somebody in the room. It was just a feeling, you know, because it just, you get that feeling. Did Moses have that feeling is kind of what I'm saying. And then in verse 8, like I have here before you, Moses quickly bowed his head and he worships God. It's not that they're standing there as big buddies and Moses is like, hey, this is great. Moses bows and worships because he knew that would be the thing to do, the right thing to do. One of the points I want to make, and I don't know if this is the best point, I don't know if this is the accurate point, but the reverence that the Jews had, like during the time that Jesus comes to the earth, they revered Moses highly. And it's not just that Moses gave the Ten Commandments, but, you know, in some ways it kind of makes you wonder that the tablets that he had to hew out himself for God to rewrite the Ten Commandments, if maybe that was kind of the attraction to the Ten Commandments, is that Moses himself, he cut these rocks. You know, it's not just the product of God who did this, it's Moses. And like I said, I don't know, I've just not come across the idea, it was just something I was thinking about reading Exodus 34, that this isn't Moses' autograph, this is God's autograph, this is God who wrote the words on the tablets, but it was Moses' handiwork to the extent that he cut these rocks out, these slabs out. The main point that I want to get to is this. With how important, and I, you know, that's kind of a word that doesn't seem to fit exactly, but this significance of the covenant between God and Israel came by the mediator of angels, we're told in the New Testament, through Moses. Moses was the one who presented God to the people of Israel. It's not just that God shows up at Mount Sinai in such a scary way and tells the people not to come near the mountain. If any animal came near the mountain, kill it. He was like scaring them, and so much so that even Moses said, let's not do this again. Never. We don't want this happening. And God agreed with Moses. But Moses was able to go to the presence of God often. But the reverence that they had for Moses, the reverence they had for the law, for whatever reason, they never saw fault. And I don't mean fault with the law, but they never saw the fault that they had themselves with the law, that they couldn't keep it. That's a point we make in the New Testament very clearly. We'll look at that here in just a minute. That the law was perfect, but people couldn't keep the law perfectly. The only person ever to do that was Jesus himself. Even Moses didn't keep it perfectly. Paul was not a perfect keeper. He would claim in Philippians 3 he was blameless, and there's a lot of debate as exactly what he meant by that. I don't think he means sinless, but you couldn't blame him. In other words, maybe he had sinned. I'm confident that he did sin. He's the one who writes in Romans 3:23, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I think he would include himself with that. But the point is blameless in the sense that whatever he had done as a sin, he also repented of. You can be blameless and still be someone who sins, because when you're confronted with your sin, you repent, you change. And that's just what I think Paul means in Philippians 3. But the significance of Jesus coming that you do not really read in the Old Testament is that when he comes, the law would be changed. Now, you might be thinking the way I'm thinking, well, there is a place where in the Old Testament it speaks of this. Let's turn together to Jeremiah chapter 31. And this is a very long time after Moses and after everything God did with dividing Israel and during the days of Rehoboam, the son of Solomon. And there are hundreds of years after that splitting of the nation of 10 tribes to the north and 2 tribes to the south. And God destroying essentially Israel as a nation by the Assyrians. That was in the close to the end of the 8th century BC. 722 is kind of the official date. But it's still almost 200 years after that event that God, with the Babylonians, comes to Judah and traps Hezekiah in the city. And it's during this time that Jeremiah prophesies to those who are in Jerusalem. And Ezekiel is the same time period, but he's prophesying to those in Babylon. But here in Jerusalem, he writes this. The first time I think anybody who was Jewish would have come across Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34 is the specific spot we have. I don't know what they would have felt. How would you feel if, and this is impossible because the New Testament isn't going to be replaced by a newer Testament, it's final, because Jesus lives forever. That's kind of the point made in Hebrews 7. We'll look at that here in just a minute. But if all of our lives and all of our fathers' lives and all of our grandfathers' lives and all of our entire culture's existence has been centered on the law, and then as we're here in Jeremiah 31, we read that's going to be replaced, I don't know how we would feel, except that's not what I asked for. I don't know about this. So Jeremiah 31:31, we read this. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Again, we're familiar with this. We've read this in a lot of different contexts, but we're like, yeah, this is old news. This wasn't old news. I wonder sometimes, Peter mentions this. Leave your marker here in Jeremiah 31. Turn over to 1 Peter chapter 1. I'll show you this real quick. This is something that I think we do do well in remembering, that when the prophets made prophecies, that's actually 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1. It is 1 Peter. I'm sorry. As soon as I'm looking at it, I'm like, that's not it. Yeah, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10 through 12. Concerning this salvation, Peter writes, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that was to be yours searched and inquired carefully, inquiring what person or time the Spirit of Christ in them was indicating when he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the subsequent glories. it was revealed to them, speaking of the prophets in verse 10, Jeremiah being one of those prophets, it was revealed to them that they were serving not themselves, but you in the things that have now been announced to you through those who preach the good news to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. So when Jeremiah wrote Jeremiah 31, it had to be a bit of a surprise to him. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant. Writing those words, what does that do with the old covenant? Well, it makes it old. You know, to say a new covenant means immediately that the old is the old. And we'll look at what the writer in Hebrews makes as his point there. But jump, go back to Jeremiah 31 with me. Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. We're at verse 32. It is not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant, notice, my covenant they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I'll make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them. And again, the shock of this is they've had these written on stone tablets for generations, hundreds, if not thousands of generations. I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will each one teach his neighbor and each his brother, saying, know the Lord, like it's a desperate cry. Know the Lord. They shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. Now, I'm going to step back for a minute. Because you remember, we read this last week when God is speaking to Moses and assuring Moses. Remember, Moses is like, I'm not going to leave these people unless you go with me. It's impossible. I'm just not doing it. And Moses is told by God, I know you by name. And I'm thinking that's kind of weird, but this makes a little bit more sense. It's not just that God says, Moses will know me. And God does speak in other contexts of knowing Moses as a man knows another man, as a man speaks to another man. And that's kind of what I'm trying to bring out here, that in Jeremiah, the prophecy is made that everybody, not just Moses, not just one person will know the Lord, but everyone will know the Lord from the least to the greatest. Declares the Lord, I will forgive their iniquity and I will remember their sin no more. Now he goes on in Jeremiah 31, and I wish we had time to read the rest of really chapters 31 through 34. It's a great, great section, but we don't have time tonight to do that. I want to go to the book of Hebrews and lead up into what the writer of Hebrews says about all this. One of the longest word-for-word quotations you're going to find in the New Testament of the Old Testament is in Hebrews chapter 8. I'll go ahead and put that there. Hebrews 8, verses 4 through 13. He quotes Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34, word-for-word from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew. We know that because there's certain phrasings in the Septuagint that are not in the Hebrew, and that's what you have here in Hebrews chapter 8. So in Hebrews 7, in verse 11 and 12, the argument that the writer has been making is about the supremacy of Jesus over the angels, over the priesthood. And in making that point, he ties it all into Melchizedek. And this is probably one of those things that the Jews didn't really pay attention to as much as we kind of think maybe they should. Melchizedek is a character in Genesis 15 that you read about for just a few verses. He's not a prominent character in the sense of you read about him a lot. You read about him once in Genesis 15. And yet God, through the writer of Hebrews, says he foreshadows the Christ. And this is kind of an argument that starts all the way back in chapter 5 where he says, I want to talk about this, but you guys have become slow of hearing, so he talks about that for a while. He comes to the point in chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, and then verse 18, 19. In 11 and 12, Hebrews 7, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? That's a good question. It's not just some kind of question. This is a good question. If perfection were there in the Levitical priesthood, then why in the world would there ever have been sought a different source? Instead of Aaron, it's Melchizedek. Why? So in verse 12, he tells us why. When there is a change in priesthood, of necessity, notice, of necessity, there is a change in the law as well. So in changing one thing, you're changing both. So let's look at verse 18 and 19. On the one hand, he says, a former commandment, just like Jeremiah says, a new covenant. Here, the writer says, a former commandment is set aside. It's set aside. Now, Paul, in Colossians 2, will say it is set aside through the blood of Jesus. So letting the Bible be its own commentary, here the writer doesn't say how it is set aside, but just that it is. A new commandment, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. That's powerful. It's not just that the writer of the book of Hebrews is saying the old law just needed to be fixed. He says it was useless. Why? Verse 19, the law made nothing perfect. That's the point. The law, with how glorious it was, and that would be a reference to 2 Corinthians 3, it had glory. Remember, Moses spent all that time with God's presence. And when Moses came down, the one thing he didn't know, that everybody else knew, was that Moses' face shone so brightly that they couldn't even look at him. Can you imagine? It sounds like a really bad sunburn, right? But he didn't feel it. It's not like he felt hot. He shone. It's hard to explain because I don't think we could explain it. But the people, as Moses talked in representing God, he left his face wide open for everybody to be, I say, seeing, but not able to see. And as soon as he was done talking for God, he would put a veil over his face. And we're not told, and we don't know how long it took for that brightness to go away or dim. But here in Hebrews 7, the point, again, let's look at verse 11, 12, and 18, 19, like it's back and forth. 11 and 12, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under the people received the law, what further need would have been? Would there have been for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek rather than the one named after the order of Aaron? That's a long verse. When there is a change in priesthood, there is of necessity a change of the law as well. Verse 18, because on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness. For the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. In other words, you can't draw near through the Old Testament, the Old Law, to God. But in the New, you can. We are brought near. But how? You can look up the phrasing, we are brought near by the blood of Christ. That's in Ephesians 2. Brought near by the blood. Now let's go to chapter 8, verse 4. Chapter 8, verse 4. The writer is continuing the same thought that he started in chapter 7, and he says this, if Jesus were on earth, he would not be a priest at all. That's a powerful statement. In other words, Jesus is a priest. He's actually, according to chapter 8, verse 1, the high priest. But if he were on the earth, which means obviously he's not, but if he were, he could not be a priest at all. It's not that God would just change the rules because it's Jesus. He didn't do that. Since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law, they serve a copy, a shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to build the tent, he was instructed by God saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown to you on the mountain. Do it the way I showed you to do it. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant that he mediates is better. So in one fell swoop, both are changed. Since it is enacted on better promises. And that's really the point. Ultimately, what God wanted for the children of Israel was to go into the land of promise, to run everybody else out, and to invade, really, the cities and not have to build cities. They'd just move in. They'd move into houses that were already built, cities that were already fortified, and they would serve God. They would worship God. And yet, they didn't want that. It's not because anybody asked, do you want it? And they said, no. It's just they sinned against God in so many ways, so many times, and yet God still used them for His purposes. As you go on in chapter 8, notice in verse 7, if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for the second. Well, where was the fault? Verse 8 tells us. If you only had verse 7, I think we would say debatably, maybe it was the law. Maybe there's a fault with the law. The law is faulty. The fault of the law, according to Paul in Romans 7, is if you break one part of it, it was like you broke the whole thing. Now, I know for most of us, you know, it's like phones, our cell phones. We treat them very well. But if you drop your phone, you know, if you don't have a case on your phone, you drop it and it cracks. I had a phone like that. I went to the gas station and put it on my motorcycle backstand, and it just fell right off, crashed, and just splintered. The screen, I mean, it all held intact. Nothing splintered off. It all was there, but it was cracked horribly. And I thought, you know, I'll live with it. I was not happy, but I said, I'll live with it. I don't have to buy a new phone until I'm swiping on whatever screen I was swiping, and I cut my finger, and I thought, you know what? I can't do this. I've got to get a new phone. The damaged part was just the screen. It wasn't the entire thing of the phone. You think of moving maybe some large glass table. I've had to do this before, and I've done this before. I'm moving a big glass table, and as you're moving it, you're trying not to hit things. Andrew was talking earlier tonight about moving furniture and all. Didn't want to hit a wall. But I've done it where I've had a big table, a glass table, and I bump into a wall, and there's this tiny little crack. Now, some people say, well, you know what you do? You cover that. But you know you can't fix it. What is now wrong? The whole thing's broken, really. And some people would tell you, because it's broken in one little spot, the whole thing's destroyed. It's just ruined. There's a Seinfeld episode where George has a cashmere sweater, and it has a little tiny, tiny, you remember, the red dot. And he keeps trying to give it to a girlfriend to give it, just as a gift. He's gifting it to everybody. And everybody, it's a woman thing, I think, was one of the jokes, is because all the men were like, well, what's there? I don't see that. The women immediately were like, they see the red dot. You know, tiny, tiny dot. Well, the whole thing's ruined. It's just garbage. Think of that. The law. And the fault of the law was if you broke the law in one point, you were guilty of the law, the entire weight of the law. And what the writer here says is verse 8, he, God, finds fault with them. The law's fault was the people keeping it. That's the point. It wasn't the law. It wasn't that God gave a law and the law was imperfect. The law was perfect. The problem was people trying to keep it. They couldn't do it. If they broke one part of it, they broke the whole thing. That was the weight of the law. Actually, Romans, Paul says, if a law could be given that could give life, then salvation would be by law. But it doesn't happen that way. So here he is in verse 8. He, God, finds fault with them. When he says, and this is where the quotation begins in verse 8, and goes through verse 12, and it's word for word, Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. So behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord. And it's almost like as the writer of Hebrews presents this, his audience would go, so that's what that meant. Because from Jeremiah until Christ is over 500 years. It's not like, you know, next week it was a new covenant. It was over 500 years. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them up out of the land of Egypt. They did not continue in my covenant. Notice that. And so I show them no concern. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. I'm going to stop here. That last part of verse 9 is different in your Old Testament than it is in the New Testament, because the Septuagint has it this way. It's just to let you know that's the difference. Verse 10, "This is the covenant that I'll make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. And they will not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they will all know me." Just like Moses, I know him, I know his name. God says, they'll all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. Verse 13 is a very, very powerful verse, because the summary is made for us. We don't have to say, I wonder what all this means. Because by the Holy Spirit, the writer tells us what it means. In speaking of a new covenant, speaking of it, he makes the first one obsolete. And what's becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. That's the power of the new covenant. Just speaking it. The writer says, just saying new covenant, immediately this is the setup that God is going to do away with the old. It is growing old. It's in that process, he shows us, and it is ready to vanish away. I wish we had time to go through the rest of chapters 9 and 10, because really that's the significance after the declaration here, is that Christ doesn't, like the blood of bulls and goats, remember in chapter 10 he says it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to cleanse any sin. It just pushed it back to the next year. It's still there. But the blood of Christ, according to chapter 9:15, cleanses conscience, the soul. That's why God gave a new covenant, because people couldn't keep the first. Jesus comes. He keeps the first, not to destroy it, but to set it aside. Just like we read earlier, he set it aside. How could he do that? Unless he fulfills it, and that's exactly what Jesus has done. I want to close with a passage here in John. John 1, verse 14, and then verses 16 through 18, where we read that the Word, which he starts off by saying, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. He then says in verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The word dwelt, you've probably heard, means to tent. And that's literally, it means to tent. But we think of dwelling, of living. He lived among us. And we have seen his glory, John says. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And then verse 16, for from his fullness, that is from Jesus' fullness, we've all received grace upon grace. It's not a little bit of grace, it's growing grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus. To a Jew, I know this would be a hard statement. To us, we're like, yeah. But to a Jew, they're like, no, Moses brought in grace and truth. But God says, no, Moses brought the law. Grace and truth came through Jesus. No one has ever seen God. You remember Moses? That was what he wanted. When God said, look, how do I give you an assurance that I'll be with you? He goes, I want to see you. Show me your glory. And God says, I can't do that. And you live. If I do that, you'll die. Remember, that's what we read last week in Exodus 34. And so God says, I'll put you in the cleft of the rock. I'm going to walk by, put my hand over so you can't see me. Until I walk by, I'll remove my hand. You can see my backside. That's amazing enough. But that was enough for Moses. But Moses never saw the face of God. When the elders of Israel sat with Moses and ate in the presence of God, they saw his feet, we're told. So they never saw the face of God. But notice, John says in verse 18 that no one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. In other words, Jesus, who is the only God, sat at the Father's side. He has made him known. He has revealed him to us. That's kind of a neat thought. It's packaged in a very simple little way, but the rest of the Gospel of John is based on this statement here, that what we're getting ready to read in the Gospel of John is proof of God the Father among us, in us. That God came to us, I think, is one of the most amazing, and it's a mind-blowing thought. It's not an easy thought. It's not the kind of thought that you're like, oh, okay, yeah, he came and visited. He came to be among us, and we know how bad things are. He visited us. Why? Not just to check out how things are, but to be with us and show us himself. That's what he really wanted. And that's what we have today. I guess Andy has the baby. So I just look back and there's no Andy's name. But you're leading singing. I don't know why I was thinking Andy. Don't bother me. This morning he led, right? Yeah, that's why I'm doing that. I'm telling you, if my brain were not actually connected to my body, sometimes I don't know what I'd be doing. The song that Patrick has chosen for us. It's an invitation song. It's number 687, correct? I want to make sure before I go off on that and we're like, no, that's not even the song. Only a step. It does take that first big step, our will to say, yes, I'm going to do this. If you've not been baptized, you have opportunity tonight. As always, when we come together, we want to close with what we call an invitation, but the invitation is God's invitation to everybody. If you're not a Christian, you can become one tonight. Not put it off and wait and wonder, but know and have confidence in God that we, in trusting Him and obeying Him, can be saved. If you are a Christian, you're not living the way you know you should, and may even want prayers of brothers and sisters to help you. Just that help itself may be a hard thing to do, but it really is a help to let everybody know. Or to let others know, maybe not everybody, but to say there are others I want to be praying for me. In either case, whether you need to be baptized or if there's some other thing that we can help and pray with you about, come forward, please, right now as we stand and sing.